Ice Cube's Big 3 is back. The most competitive basketball league on earth is on CBS this Saturday. Big 3 All-Star Dwight Howard and the LA Riot take on Greg Monroe and the Dallas Power. Then Coach Rick Mahorn, Sensation Nasir Khor, and the Detroit Amps look to protect home court against back-to-back MVP Michael Beasley and the defending champs Miami 305. The game played the way you love. Watch live Saturday on CBS at 4 p.m. Eastern, 1 p.m. Pacific, and catch replays on BET.
Folks, it is Freaky Friday, and good news, it's the end of the offseason. Maybe not officially. There's still 13 days until Ohio State opens spring practice, but this weekend, there's a softball game where there's Ohio State players. Burnham and I are going to be out there to talk to some Buckeyes, and then we're heading to Las Vegas on Monday for Big Ten Media Day, so talking season has arrived, and then the start of practice is going to be arriving shortly after that, so can't wait. It is Friday on the beat. This is the Austin and Berm Show. I am Austin, and he is Berm.
With that.
No, oh, okay, but no, seriously, if talking season starts Monday, what have we been doing?
Well, it's always talking season for us, but now it's talking season for the Buckeyes.
I just wanted to bring back the with that from the Buckeye commercials. I feel like there's certain things in life every once in a while that deserve a redo, and that's one of them for me, for sure.
Well, for sure. There seems to be a lot of things that you want to bring back. You're trying to bring back the dab. You wanted Chip Kelly to twerk.
I want people to acknowledge that Ellie De La Cruz has been trying to bring back the dab for the last 2 years, and other people are just not acknowledging it because he's not hitting enough home runs. Well, hit more homers.
Should tell you that it's dead, and what is dead may never die. So thank you to everyone who has been filling up the email inbox. That is the Austin and Berm Show at gmail.com. And awesome to interact in that way. I don't know why we never had an email address for the show in the past, Berm. It's like pretty cool to be getting questions like that and having some questions and topics in our way, not just for a Freaky Friday, but like, hey, why don't you guys talk about this? And it's like, you know what? We probably should do that.
Yeah.
And maybe next offseason, we'll just let everyone else fill up the content plan for us
Okay, Thomas, so your decision today. This is Thomas Tuesday.
Yeah. Well, Tuesday's taken. That is a
welcome to Willie Wednesday.
There we go. So that's been pretty cool, and it was awesome to read some of those ideas and thoughts and feedback and input. Mostly positive. Pretty refreshing to see some of that. But great questions for the Friday mailbag. So we are back for round two of that. Couldn't get to all of them, but there is still another Friday before camp starts. So who knows? There might be a trilogy of questions. And we will start with this one from Matt. I had to cut this down. There was a lot of thought that went into this, and he gave a lot of examples from previous Ohio State teams. Very well thought out. I wish I could read it all to you, but I'm not going to be able to. It's from Matt. He said, who do you guys see as glue guys from past title teams? And maybe some speculation on who these guys are for this year who will refuse to lose, selfless leaders who do a lot of different things and aren't a top three round pick.
Well, now reading that again makes me want to change what I'm thinking here, because I thought it said top three pick initially. So I thought it was like top three total in the draft pick.
You thought it was limited exclusively to the very
I was like, man, this
best?
Is going to be super easy. but the player that first came to my mind, and it wasn't from a title team, unfortunately, when he was really the guy that I'm talking about, is Tyquan Lewis. I think about like that 2017 defensive line and how much fanfare and accolades there were for Chase Young throughout his career, and the Bosa's, and even Sam Hubbard being an Ohio guy that everyone loved, and the dodgeball story and everything else that came with it. But Tyquan was like always making plays and was always there and playing and leading and being a guy that like was accountable. And it was just, you know, when you think about like those games that the defensive line took over in that couple year stretch, like Tyquan Lewis was always in the middle of it. So he was the first guy that really came to my mind, but he was a second round pick as I look back now. So, Jonathan Cooper clearly is one of those guys. You know, he was playing out of position, if we're being honest, and is a better NFL player productivity wise than he was at Ohio State, because he's playing the right position now. And if you think about like as a leader, like there's nobody there are few guys that have been as good or better than Jonathan Cooper in the last decade plus.
Yeah, I think back to the national championship team now from a decade ago, 2014. There was really one on each side of the football that I can recall. It was like, don't know how long these NFL careers are going to be. Don't know if they're both going to get drafted. Michael Bennett certainly did. He did not get enough credit. Sort of some parallels there with Ty Hamilton. Same position, same productivity, same heart and soul. Michael Bennett was maybe a little bit more vocal than Ty Hamilton was. But just imagining what those defensive lines or defenses would have looked like without
Either Hamilton brother. I mean, yeah, honestly.
I'm trying to limit it to like the national title teams, at least right now. Because I think that's what Matt's hoping to get at. It's like, well, who could inspire Ohio State to that level to go defend the national championship this year? So I think of Evan Spencer and Michael Bennett for the 2014 team. Ty Hamilton goes right back in that same conversation for the reigning national champions. Just a whole host of other guys, if you're saying not top three round draft.
Yeah, I mean, Seth McLaughlin last year was, and I don't know if he really counts because he's just a one-year rental guy from Alabama, but does that team get where it got without Seth? I don't think it does. The way that he guided Carson Hinsman and helped bring Carson along in what could have been a much different outcome for Carson, I think gets overlooked and will get overlooked. But there's a lot of guys. Who's the guy this year though that you start to look at, or I should be just give a guy on each side of the ball? Cause I mean, I think that's fair.
Yeah. I don't want to, this is maybe too obvious. I don't think that Carson Hinsman is going to be a top three round pick, honestly. Whether that is fair or not, or deserved or not, it's a position where you don't always see teams spend a ton of capital. If you're maybe viewed as the third or fourth most athletic center, I think he's going to win the Remington Trophy, and Ohio State, as it retools here with a new starting quarterback, having that battery and the security of a veteran center is just critical. And you can say the same for Austin Sereveld, but I've talked about both of those guys a lot. I think they're maybe fairly obvious selections. I don't know how. I don't want to go Anthony Schlegel at Rooster style and name the entire roster, but I don't know if Brandon Ennis is going to have the kind of season where he's going to be in position to be a super early draft pick or even leave early. Yeah. But man, it unless we mention it, I think it sometimes goes forgotten that he was on the leadership committee a year ago, despite, you know, rarely playing for Ohio State behind Emeka Ebuka. And if you're talking about selflessness, his decision to come back in, you know, when he would have had no shortage of interest in the transfer portal and high dollar offers to leave, to sit behind a Mecca for another year, incredibly selfless, proven leader.
You talk about refuse to lose, like he's that guy.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable competitor. And leader, yeah, he's already on the leadership committee. So, and doing a lot of different things. We highlighted his block in the Rose Bowl on Travion's touchdown run there down in the red zone. Phenomenal. Stick your face on somebody, put him in the dirt. Just great work from Brandon Ennis there. Key touchdown catch at Penn State. That's easier to see than maybe some of the blocking, but he's going to have to do all of that again for Ohio State. So if you look beyond the offensive lineman, I think Brandon Ennis qualifies for me on the offensive side. And now I've taken three that are off the board that you can't have now.
Yeah. I mean, I'm trying to talk about guys maybe that we haven't talked about as much, because I think that's what this question is really trying to get at. And I think about someone like Bennett Christian, who's been through a ton of stuff at Ohio State in the time he's been there. Some of it self-inflicted on his part, not, you know, knowing exactly what he was putting in his body 2 years ago that cost him an entire season. But like what he brings to that room and what he brings is just the maturity and the leadership that he has as a tight end, and the physicality, the willingness to just go out there and hit people without really ever expecting the football. Like that to me is what you're talking about. And I mean, someone we talk about a lot, but I'm as I sit here and think about it, the parallels between CJ Hicks and Jonathan Cooper are kind of sticking out to me. You know, the difference is that CJ Hicks has been in the wrong position for his entire career, but he's getting a chance to play the right position as a Buckeye, where Jonathan didn't, or Javi or Coop or whatever you want to call him. But Coop, like was a five-star recruit, local kid. I don't know that he lived up to the expectations as far as the productivity went on the field, but he was the face of the 2016 recruiting class, a guy that was always front and center, leading, never afraid to talk about what he was feeling, never afraid to get out and say if something was bothering him. And I think CJ's similar in a lot of ways, a lot of respects. The Captain Buckeye moniker he earned in the class of 2022, like, has not faded. He still loves Ohio State. He's a guy that could have left multiple times and could have left probably more justifiably than a lot of kids who've left the program in the last few years could have. But he stuck it out and he's there and he's in a position to be a glue guy, because that sort of resiliency matters. And that sort of toughness, finds a way to permeate the rest of the team. And I think that he's just someone that, you know, whether or not he becomes the statistical dominator that we all believed he might be when he committed to Ohio State 4 years ago, like, he's in a position now to prove a different style of leadership, and so far so good for him.
Let me throw this one at you. Every time that I wildly speculate and try to figure out what's going to happen at nickel, we say, oh, and Lorenzo Styles is back, and he started there for most of spring. I don't know how many snaps he's going to play this year. I know he's not going to be a top 3-round pick, but the combination of Sonny and Lorenzo's work ethic, I think the sacrifice to play different positions, you know, coming back from Notre Dame and trying to learn something over from scratch, being a wide receiver and now playing corner and playing in the slot, you're never going to compete against any member of the Styles family and get an easy victory. Like, they're going to relentlessly fight for everything that's out there. And I think that Lorenzo's opportunity for playing time and just to, like, be around the program, and you don't ever see him take days off, work ethic off, giving back off the field. He and Sonny, you know, did their night out for the Huckleberry House in late May again. I mean, he checks all those boxes that you want for your program. And, you know, I think sometimes there were plays and snaps where Lorenzo was on the field last year and it didn't look great. And it's like, okay, well, let's move on to the next thing. He's still learning how to do that. I don't want to write him off for the role that he can play. And I definitely don't want to do that in terms of the veteran mentality, work ethic, leadership piece that he brings to this team, because I think that that is recognized pretty widely in the Woody.
Yeah, I mean, I think that he's a guy that is going to start for Ohio State. I don't know that I put him in this conversation, because as I read Matt's question, I'm thinking of, like, the fiery leader type. Maybe we don't get that vocal leadership out of him the way that some of these other guys we've mentioned do. I think it's, why is his last name escaping me? Tanner from Oklahoma State.
McAllister.
Yeah, like, I think that you could see a similar sort of impact from Lorenzo on this defense as Tanner McAllister had, where it's like, he's solid, he's going to be out there, but you know that there's other guys that are coming up behind him that might be more talented in the role, but it doesn't take away from the value that he has in the spot to bring those guys along. And so Lorenzo definitely is a guy, but he's going to start. He's going to be a guy that leads this defense in some way, shape, or form. And his maturity certainly stands out amongst everything else that you already said about him.
Yeah. So thanks to Matt for that question. A good thinker, both about the past and the present. This came from Mike. And there was also more to this question that I didn't squeeze in there. As you can see, there's still plenty of text for me to read if you are watching along on 10TV Plus, 10TV, or 97.1 The Fan's YouTube channel. And Mike says, I've been trying to figure out why they did not redshirt Julian Sain last year, considering he only played in 4 games. So he would be eligible. He would be a redshirt freshman this year instead of a sophomore, which would likely lead to us keeping him for one more season. I understand he can still leave after being a redshirt sophomore, but given the current quarterback battle, it's no guarantee he starts this season. God forbid an injury happens this year or next, we would have the flexibility to keep him around. Any insight as to what goes into those types of decisions?
First and foremost, the playoff games don't count against your playing games. And so he only played in 3 games, right?
I believe he actually does have the red shirt available to him.
Yeah. I just think we've entered a different era of college football. He only played against Western Michigan, Michigan State, and Purdue in the regular season. So he does technically have his red shirt year available. The difference is that we no longer have to call someone a red shirt, whatever. You just say, this is year two. If he wants to take a red shirt in year five, he's he's willing to play and he's able to play in year five. I just think it's a terminology issue. That rule was changed, obviously, a couple of years ago to give guys an opportunity to play without burning a year of eligibility. So he has his red shirt intact, but no one's redshirted until their final eligibility is up. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, let's take the question on face value, set that aside. Let's work under the premise that they burned a red shirt for him. Mm-hmm. I don't think that Ohio State. So if we're asking for insight on the decisions that Ryan Day is making in concert with Brian Hartline, Billy Fessler, with quarterbacks, the caliber of quarterbacks that they recruit, the caliber of quarterbacks that they develop, the now expense that comes with building a well-stocked depth chart at quarterback, I'm not sure that there is ever going to be a value. It sounds crazy. Maybe there's going to be a situation that I'm not thinking of immediately offhand. I don't think there's going to be a quarterback that stays at Ohio State for 5 years, ever again.
Yeah, it's highly unlikely. You're going to see a very similar outcome this year for Tavian St. Clair as far as his numbers and his statistics go, I'd imagine. But for a five-star kid from California who transferred in from Alabama after 1 week of being in Tuscaloosa, the odds of him staying beyond 3 years one way or another are super low. So there's no point in saying don't play. And we've had this conversation multiple times about how important it is that your high profile freshmen get opportunities to play in football games during the season. It doesn't hurt them to play anymore. So, you know, you just have to say, we're going to put you out there so that you can get a taste because, hey, these kids have family members flying in from all over the country for these games. You don't want to just sit them on the bench when they could play against Western Michigan when it's 56-0. So you aren't going to get that guy for 4 years in most cases. He's only going to be there for three if you're an Ohio State five-star quarterback prospect. So there's just no point in holding him back.
Yeah, and I think...
And sorry to interrupt. We saw the exact opposite approach when it came to Lincoln Kienholz last year, right? Like that was a true developmental year for him. And that's a different case because Lincoln was not the same profile of recruit that Julian was. And Lincoln was forced to play in his first year at Ohio State and then probably realized pretty quickly, okay, maybe it's not going to hurt me to take this year as a development year. So I think there's just, it's two sides of the same coin, right? Like the result's going to be the same. 3 or 4 years at most for anybody is pretty much the standard now.
Yeah. And I think, I don't want this to be an NIL transfer portal era house settlement conversation, but given the current ability of player movement at every position, but especially quarterback, there's just no such thing as a 5-year roster building plan anymore. It is a year to year situation. I mean, if you think back 18 months ago, the plan did not include Julian Sain in any way, shape, or form for Ohio State. Right. So you have to be able to adjust. And I understand Mike's point. If you can retain that redshirt, that does give you more flexibility for a long-term vision. But you can't afford to have those anymore at quarterback. There is more immediacy to that. And as you mentioned with Lincoln Kienholz, the fact that he did use that as a redshirt year, it would be stunning if that year actually worked to Ohio State's advantage when it came to year five of his college career. That would be helping some other program and not necessarily Ohio State.
Right. So that fifth year and the availability of it is generally now a matter of like a buffer for the players themselves, not for the school, especially not at a place like Ohio State.
Yeah. But still very much appreciate that question from Mike. And this came from Ryan. He was, I guess, I'm so far removed and from last year at this point and just thinking about the national championship that I've forgot about the week after week conversation about the tempo that Ohio State played with last year. But Ryan has certainly not. He said, do you think the staff will intentionally try to be the third slowest playing offense in the country this season, or will they try to pick up the pace? I get the strategy and trying to limit snaps to prevent injuries, but couldn't you try and mimic the 2021 MSU game? Michigan State blowout, blow the doors off opponents early, then sub out your starters at halftime. It accomplishes the same thing, except now you'd be able to get your second and third string much more game reps. I would love to see, and Berm, I think we had a lot of snap judgments and conversations throughout the week a year ago. It's like, hey, can't you just play a quarter and a half and be up four touchdowns and coast to the finish line. Like, that seems like a pretty doable strategy. And every time that that was broached, and we asked Ryan Day about it, we asked Chip Kelly about it. It's like, this is the plan. It is a 16 to 17 game plan. They feel like their talent is going to win out in most games, whether they were, and they weren't trying to win style points. I think maybe, to Ryan's point, there is a world where Ohio State does push the pedal down a little bit earlier in some of these games in a way that it may not have last year, because it that can get you into some wonky situations. I'm thinking primarily about Nebraska. You have so much more talent than that team. You should not be in a four quarter battle with a team like that. Or, but sometimes, you know, college football is a crazy game, and sometimes the bounces don't go your way, or you don't execute perfectly every single Saturday. I certainly understand that. And I'm not coming at this from the vantage point that Ohio State has to beat every opponent by 50 and it has to play everybody on the roster in every single game. But I think varying the tempo more would have a lot more, potentially a lot more benefits for this team. And I wonder if now in hindsight, Ryan Day can point to the trophy and say, hey, this worked just fine. Or if he'd say, I might have saved myself a gray hair or two if we just got a little bit more aggressive with the passing attack or went tempo in some of these games in the first half. Maybe that will become more of an option for Brian Hartline, because I think that certainly suits his personality maybe more than Chip Kelly's.
Yeah, and I also think that it was a matter of getting comfortable with Will Howard and letting Will become the leader of the offense. I don't think that there was a lot of consistency in the passing game in the early part of the season last year. I do think that as you headed into the playoffs, we saw Ohio State get more aggressive against Tennessee, against Oregon, against Notre Dame in that first half. And I think those results speak for themselves. I personally am a pedal to the metal guy all the way. I think you should go out every drive and try to score points. I don't think Ohio State was intentionally avoiding points, but certainly Chip Kelly's methods are different than what Brian Hartline's are going to be as far as setting up the defense and trying to get them in position for certain plays to hit later in the game. I hated watching the offense be that slow. I mean, but when it came down to it, Ohio State still finished 28th in total offense, still had 430 yards a game of offense, still scored quite a bit of points, still averaged 7 yards a play. Like, they still did a lot of very good things. It's just not the style we had become accustomed to with Justin Fields and CJ Stroud at quarterback. And so I don't know. I think it always is going to fall back on the quarterback and how comfortable he is running tempo. I think that suits Julian Sain's abilities very well. So we'll see how Ryan Day handles it. The explanation of, well, it's a long season, we want to make sure guys are healthy. I don't think that that made no sense to me, because like the year before, Ryan and the coaches were regularly lamenting the fact that they were having less plays in the game than they ever did before. So I don't know how the mindset or the mentality would have shifted that much in a year, but it seems to me like the point made by Ryan here is correct. Like, if you just get up 35-0 in the second quarter, then you can get those guys a break that way.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's a matter of, as you said, they were still scoring a lot of points, but if you are, you know that Ohio State's opponents are going to maximize the play clock and try and extend drives. If they get two first downs, they're going to take 7 minutes off the clock. That is their goal, to shorten the game. And Ohio State, I felt like they were allowing that to happen to them because they were also playing at a more methodical pace. And that, you had like games where there were four possessions and you're like, Ohio State has no chance of losing this game, but they're not dominating it on the scoreboard. They were voluntarily, now again, it was a sacrifice in their mind for the long-term benefit of the program, but they were volunteering to cut down on their talent superiority. They were giving away their edge by not playing as many possessions as possible, or trying to get as many possessions as possible. And that allows you to be like, as that margin of error shrinks, and they were scoring like two out of every three times and putting points up on the board, but your opponent then only, they don't have as many. If they score once, they're like, they're going to go into halftime and feel great.
I think people would look at last year in a vacuum and assume that Ohio State was outscored by teams like Oregon. Ohio State averaged more points a game than Oregon last year. Ohio State of the playoff teams, of the 12 teams in the playoff, Ohio State was fourth in per game scoring, tied with Tennessee, and only Indiana and Notre Dame and SMU were scored more points per game than those teams. So, like, you wouldn't look at last year and think, well, Notre Dame was a higher scoring team than Ohio State, but they were. But also, like, we know Indiana played a crappy schedule. We know SMU played a crappy schedule. So, like, we saw what Indiana did when they played Ohio State and Notre Dame on offense, right? So, like, I think some of these numbers are obviously skewed, and that's the beauty of numbers, is statistics, is you can make them say whatever you want. But the Buckeyes' yardage and points and all that stuff was down from the last couple of years, but it was not like a noticeable decline as far as the productivity of the offense. It still was a top 15 offense by pretty much every metric.
Yeah. Imagine if Ohio State played like Western Indiana and scored a billion points. That would skew the numbers pretty well. By the way, like, what is Kurt Cignetti doing with his schedule? It is the most, even James Franklin is embarrassed by what he's doing. Just absolutely ridiculous. Hoosiers, get it together.
I think he learned a lesson last year. Like, as long as you win every game against the teams you're supposed to beat, you're going to get in the playoff.
I don't schedule tough teams. Google me. Kyle said Jeremiah Smith had 1,315 yards last year and needs 1,554 this year to become the all-time leading receiver at Ohio State. What are the chances that this happens? First of all, I can't believe that that's all it takes, given the like lengthy list of superstar wide receivers. Now, some of them only need to play 3 years at Ohio State and they're off to the next level. So, you know, what Chris Carter's freshman record was in the like 600s before Jeremiah shattered it last year. So I understand that it's hard to rack that up over multiple years, but it's still shocking to me that the number is that low.
1,554 divided by 12 games is 129.5 yards a game for Jeremiah Smith. So is that likely? No, it's not. Even for a player like him to average 130 yards a game receiving is not going to be easy, considering the way defenses are going to play against him. If Ohio State plays 16 games, it's only 97 yards a game that he needs. So that becomes more doable. So I think the chances of breaking that record next year are pretty much entirely contingent on the team success. But certainly JJ can go for 200 in any week if teams try to play him straight up or in any sort of man situation. So we'll see. I doubt it. I doubt that happens this year, but I mean, he's certainly in a position to do that at the middle point of his junior season. And I think have a chance to put it out of reach for any future Ohio State receiver.
All right. So Kyle said, what are the chances? I would say,
how are we accumulating? How are we accounting for this? Are we doing percentages? Are we doing 1 in 10?
I was going to say more likely than not, and I would land around like 60%. And I have agreed. We've talked about JJ all this offseason. How are you going to adjust to double coverage? Our teams, they're going to take the Texas route. Is that what they're going to put someone over the top for every single snap of every single game? I don't think I think there's going to be teams that gamble on their top corner and they're going to try to win the game that way without letting Carnell Tate and Brandon Innes eat them alive. So especially if I believe that Ohio State is going to win the Big Ten, that gets them to 13 games. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, 3 playoff games, potentially. We'll see what happens. But they're going to play at least 14 games. Who knows how the bracket will shake out and what the quarterback situation will look like. But that is not a number that is out of reach because, as you mentioned, he can take a slant route and go 75 yards on the first play of the game against Texas, and I won't be surprised. And then suddenly that's well within reach and you're ahead of schedule. So I think more likely than not is where I land.
111 yards per game in a 14 game season. So again,
that's still a lot. Yeah.
Yeah. That's tough. I personally would say less likely than likely. But I do think that he is in a position to challenge it. Last year per game, JJ averaged 1,315 yards, right? Out of how many games?
16.
1,315 divided by 16, he had 83 yards a game. So a 16 game season this year, he'd need to average 15 yards a game more than he did last year. I think that's unlikely just because of the attention he's going to get. So I say unlikely heading into season.
What do we always say? This is not a math show. I don't
know. Yeah, but I mean, it turned into one, and thank God for calculators.
This was a fun one from Alex. He also gave some very nice compliments about discovering our podcast in the last couple of years. And we thank you for following along very much so. So he said he had a hypothetical. So what do you think would be the most interesting or entertaining combination of Buckeye head coaches in era in which they coached? For example, he said Woody Hayes coaching today or Urban Meyer taking over after Jim Cooper was fired instead of Jim Tressel. I think this is a fun question, and I have a cop-out answer that I'm just going to say it from the start. We had on the Buckeye show like a week or so ago with Beam, it's like, who was the best hire of this of the last 25 years for Ohio State? Was it Jim Tressel? Was it Urban Meyer or Ryan Day? And I feel like every single coach was the right coach at the right time, and Ohio State hit the absolute home run. And if you moved them out of their eras, that the success would not have been the same. The way I actually landed on it was that the more I talked about it, the more I realized that Jim Tressel's job setting that foundation, then for Urban to build on top of that in the way that he did, and then what Ryan Day has been able to do in this very different era, which I just don't. Urban Meyer's not coaching for a reason. He's on Big Noon Kickoff for a reason. He does not want to deal with NIL. He does not want to deal with the transfer portal. A lot of these other coaches, Jim Tressel included, going back to Woody, it was about the control, and it was about five-year plans for building your roster. So I think that Ohio State has been incredibly fortunate, and I strongly believe that all those guys, they nailed the hires. And we can say, oh, Urban was obvious, and he was sitting right there, and it was time to pass the torch from the Tressel era. Fine. It doesn't matter. You still had to go actually do it. And then Urban had to deliver on that. If you were trying for the entertainment purposes, I'll try and answer the question after that. But I think that's important because it shouldn't be taken for granted that Ohio State has done, when we talk about them being recession proof, if you get the hires wrong, you can ask Tennessee, or you can ask Alabama, or you can ask Georgia how quickly it can get sideways if you don't get that part right.
I'm going to try to answer this for Alex from a different perspective, and it's this. Of those coaches that we've seen since Woody Hayes, right? So let's say you got Woody, you got Earl, you've got Coop, you've got Tress, you've got Urban and Ryan. I think the one coach who would have been as successful in any era as he was his own era is Jim Tressel. Okay. I think his temperament, I think his ability to control narrative, I think his ability to politic, I think his ability to be a leader in the sport. I think his very subtle assassin mindset that people didn't really know would have been in his competitive spirit. He would have been just as good in the 60s as he would be today. I firmly believe that. I think Jim Tressel is probably better suited for today's era of football than he was even in his own time. But beyond that, I'm trying to think like who would, like I would think it'd be hilarious to watch a guy like Woody Hayes in today's era, but I also don't know that I see much of a difference in style or substance between Woody Hayes and Urban Meyer as far as what Urban would be like in today's era. So at the risk of not answering the question as intended, to me, the question should be who fits no matter what. And I think it would be Jim Tressel. And I think Ryan Day would probably be second on that list. But I also think guys like John Cooper are underrated in Ohio State history just because he didn't win the games that people are going to remember him for. But Coop was, he's a Hall of Fame college football coach, so he was also pretty darn good.
Yeah. I mean,
I was too young to really know much about Earl Bruce, so I apologize for like skipping over that decade, but I was just too young to really know much about him.
Yeah. So we all know what the knock on Coop is, and you can put Jim Tressel or Urban Meyer on those teams in the 90s, and how different would that look? I mean, the national championship, and that's not even a situation where you have to say you needed Urban's recruiting chops and his aggression, because all the talent was already assembled on those Ohio State teams. Like that part, you can't you can't question what Cooper was able to do with those rosters. Like they,
he was an incredible recruiter.
That's what makes it so confounding for people. So in that respect, I think if you take either Tress or Urban, you flip a coin and you put them in the 90s, that's the only spot that you would look back. And you, and I understand your point too, that it's like, that makes Coop somewhat underrated or open to maybe unfair criticism, however you want to view it.
It's not unfair. It is what it is. You go 2-10-1 against Michigan. People are not going to look back on your era and think that you, you know, capitalized on it, period.
Yeah.
I think that, as you mentioned, what Coop was missing in that time frame was just a killer instinct. And that is something that we know Urban Meyer has, we know Jim Tressel has, and we know Ryan Day has.
Yeah. So if you put either one of those guys, which again is yet another cop-out answer for me on this, but like the level of attention for the last game on the season, when it was more important than it has ever been because of the difficulty and the path to get to the Big Ten championship game and how that was a prerequisite to winning it, all these other goals, like that was the era where you had to have, as Urban Meyer would always call it, that laser focus. And I wasn't around. I didn't cover that team in the 90s. So it's that's the part that's maybe unfair for me to say. I don't know how Cooper was on a day-to-day basis with that, or Michigan drills or Team Up North drills or whatever. Like, I wasn't around for that. But I was, for years and for every day of Urban Meyer's tenure, seeing how he approached it. And sometimes that came at the expense of some of the lesser games on the schedule. And that would be fascinating if he would have had this, Urban would have had the same attention to Indiana and Illinois in the mid-90s and handle all those games and avoid any upsets. Who knows? I don't want to act like Urban was infallible.
Yeah. The interesting thing about those 90 in the 90s is that like Illinois, Purdue, Wisconsin, Iowa, like all those teams were good. Like there was not, I think because Jim Tressel changed the recruiting philosophy a little bit and redirected it to building up a wall around Ohio and all that stuff, people are under the presumption or assumption that it was the Urban Meyer era of Ohio State football that really reopened the doors nationally for Ohio State recruiting. And that's when the program went to a coast-to-coast recruiting approach. That's not true. John Cooper was very, very into national recruiting and was a remarkable recruiter. He just could not get out of his own way when it came to Michigan. What you saw with Urban and what you saw with Tress was that, like, they hated Michigan. And I think that that's an important piece of the puzzle for an Ohio State coach. And I don't think, as someone growing up in Northwest Ohio, watching that rivalry in the 90s, John Cooper oftentimes just sort of brushed it off as another game. And that was never going to work. And what changed when Tress took over and when Urban was there is that, it was no longer just another game. Even if you had bigger goals, even if you had a goal that included winning a national championship, like, you have to hate that team. And I don't think that Cooper did. And I think, in fact, he ended up like resenting a lot of the Ohio State fan base because they hated Michigan so much that it didn't matter what else he did. And you know, not that it matters now. Coop is always around the building still. I think it's a really remarkable testament to Ohio State football and the brand that it is, that like John Cooper has an office at Ohio State and is just there all the time, always hanging out. So, you know, it's cool to see. Like, he obviously still loves Ohio State, but he never got that rivalry. And in the 80s, the Buckeyes just were not that talented at times. Like, but in the 90s, like, if you look at NFL draft, if you look at us, like, it was John Cooper who brought back this era of SEC style Ohio State football.
I'm sure his birth certificate says Jonathan Cooper. I think you can call
probably
him. Probably. I don't know for sure, though. All right. Last one for this week. Thanks again to everybody who sent these questions in. The Austin and Berm Show at gmail.com. That is the Austin and Berm Show at gmail.com. Feel free to reach out with any of your thoughts, feedback, maybe another mailbag coming after we get back from Las Vegas. But I thought this was pretty interesting. Wanted to get Berm's thoughts because we've seen RJ Day at these summer recruiting camp since he was like, I don't know, 8 years old, and he started to get offers from bigger and bigger schools. Yeah. So Zach said, where does RJ Day end up and how does that affect Ryan Day as a head coach, whether he ends up at Ohio State or another school? Will it end up being either a distraction or an emotional pull for Ryan Day? Very interesting question.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think it'll be a distraction or an emotional pull for him. We watched Urban Meyer's career happen when Nate went away to Cincinnati to play baseball there. It's maybe it's a little different because it's football and RJ is putting himself in a position to get some offers and have opportunities. I think he's into double digit opportunities now, including like Syracuse and Cincinnati, et cetera, schools like that, Boston College, a lot of MAC schools. I don't mean to speak out of turn here for anybody. I am confident RJ does not want to play at Ohio State. He wants to, you know, build his own path. He's still got 2 years left of high school. He's developed himself into a pretty good quarterback in the last couple of years. He's about 6 foot one and a half now, over 210 pounds, like really filling out, turning into a pretty decent mid-level power, you know, group of five quarterback prospect. So he just has to decide, really, like, what does he want to do? Does he want to take football and play it, or does he want to take football and use it to develop him into a coach, or does he want to do other things? I don't know that he has the natural ability to end up with an NFL ceiling, but he's extremely cerebral. He's very smart. He understands the game pretty well. But as far as where he wants to go to college, he's still got to decide that. I know that Boston College is one that's caught his attention. I know that the relationship with Syracuse is good. We'll see if anybody else comes around and offers. Maybe Michigan will offer him like they did Chase Herbstreit last year for no reason, just to try to play around Troll. With Ryan Day's emotions. But will it affect Ryan Day? I don't think so. Ryan is under contract through 2032. He has long insinuated in conversations that his goal is to be at Ohio State at least all the way through his kids being in high school. There's still other kids to come up through the, you know, the area high schools, and I don't think that's going to impact anything.
RJ has spent so much time in the Woody and in the Horseshoe that it is hard for me to imagine him not spending at least 2 years at Ohio State to get developed, to actually like be in a Mickey Marotti strength program, and to have his dad or Billy Fessler or Brian Hartline working with him, and then like being even more prepared potentially. If the ceiling for RJ Day is Cincinnati starting quarterback,
that's pretty good.
That's good. But you don't have to start there. You might get it. You don't have to start your career at Cincinnati. You might be better positioned to start at Cincinnati by spending 2 or 3 years in the Ohio State development program. And I'm not forcing that on him. I'm not saying that I think that's going to happen. If you're just asking me what scenario do I envision in my mind after watching him like grow up before our eyes and all the relationships that he's built with Ohio State starting quarterbacks over the years, if his dad says, you know, you can have a, you know, a nice little preferred walk-on spot here for a couple years and you're going to get all these benefits until you're ready to then spread your wings. And I'm not saying he's not ready to spread his wings right now. Maybe he is. Yeah. I don't know. I would never force him to answer that question, to be fully honest with you, because what are you going to say? Of course, it's everyone's. If your dad is a head coach who's won a national championship, that's most boys' dream. I loved when my dad was my coach and I was just in elementary school. Like, that's a cool thing. Most sons look up to their fathers. And that would be a unique opportunity. I don't think that would be different for RJ, but that's the balance. You want to go somewhere else and be your own man and not be around your family anymore. And every single person has to make that decision. What makes RJ's unique is that his dad could give him an opportunity that like every other kid, every other quarterback in the state of Ohio dreams of.
Well, and what's interesting about it is that as a class of 2027 prospect, Ohio State does have a commitment in that class from a quarterback already in Brady Edmonds, but they are looking for a second quarterback. The likelihood is that eventually, if they're resolute in the idea of taking a second quarterback, that player will end up coming from inside of Ohio's borders, because it is hard to bring in a player from out of the state who wants to be in a two-man quarterback class. Now, again, I have spoken to RJ about this stuff because I cover recruiting and he's a football player and he plays high school ball and he has offers from a lot of schools around the area. I don't think that his goal right now is not to be at Ohio State. I think that what the path you're describing, like go into a program like Ohio State and learn, is actually one of the decisions he has to make. But I could see that happening just as easily at Texas or Clemson or Georgia or anywhere else, because while he's been with his dad this whole time, and he obviously him and Ryan have a great relationship. Ryan helps coach his 7-on-7 team over at at St. Francis de Sales. So like he's around. I think RJ sees the weight of the Ohio State football program and what it's done to his family in the last couple of years, and probably is okay with the idea of sharpening his teeth somewhere else.
Yeah, no, that makes sense too. Thanks to all those questions that we got to, and thank you to all for sending some that we even didn't get to. As I mentioned, the Cardale Jones charity softball game is Saturday. Berm and I are planning to be there, and we're going to see if we can execute a version of the notebook for this game. There's going to be a lot of current and former Buckeyes down at Huntington Park. Forecast looking a little bit dicey. I guess either way, they're going to try and play a game, and if they can't, they'll play as long as they can. If they have to just sign autographs in the concourse, they'll do that too. But no matter what, we'll be there on Saturday, so we'll hope to bring you some new interviews. Probably not from the guys who are going to be in Las Vegas on Tuesday, because we are setting aside some time to sit down with Ryan Day, Caleb Downs, Sonny Styles, and Jeremiah Smith there. So we'll get through this weekend.
Hopefully Ross Bjork too.
Yep. Working on that. Either way, even if it's after we get back, we're on the docket for Ross Bjork to get some insight. I know there's a ton of questions about things that have nothing to do with the actual on-field product. So we'll get to some of that with the Ohio State Athletic Director. But there will be weekend content coming in one form or fashion. Then we'll have the beat as you'd expect on Monday morning. And then we'll be traveling out there to Las Vegas and providing the on-site coverage for 10 TV Plus, 97.1 The Fan, and I don't know, whatever else everything we can else. Come up with. Yeah, yeah. It's exciting. We're here. It's time to get in. We're within 2 weeks of training camp, and it's a really exciting time on the beat. Sorry for longer than, well, I'm not sorry. It's fun to get questions from you, and the mailbag went long for a Freaky Friday, but you know that's what we do around here. Thanks again to everyone. Have a great weekend. He's Berm. I'm Austin. We'll see you on Saturday.
Ice Cube's Big 3 is back. The most competitive basketball league on earth is on CBS this Saturday. Big 3 All-Star Dwight Howard and the LA Riot take on Greg Monroe and the Dallas Power. Then Coach Rick Mahorn, Sensation Nazir Kaur, and the Detroit Amps look to protect home court against back-to-back MVP Michael Beasley and the defending champs Miami 305. The game played the way you love. Watch live Saturday on CBS at 4 p.m. Eastern, 1 p.m. Pacific, and catch replays on BET.
Yay!